My policy is going to be to just paint everything blue. Hello, listeners. No, that's terrible. I'm not going to do that. So welcome to episode 3 of Increments with your hosts and sole guests and the only two people who are currently listening to the podcast, so sole listeners as well, Ben and Vaden. In this episode, we discussed the prison abolition movement, which is a movement kind of started by Angela Davis and Ruth Wilson Gilmore, who are advocating for living in a society that just does not have prisons at all. And so we discussed that, and then we kind of use that as a springboard to discuss the larger topic of incremental change versus revolutionary change. And from there, we actually got the name of our podcast, so that's where the name came from. But yeah, I thought it was a pretty good conversation overall.
We covered some interesting ground, I think. And I do just want to issue the one caveat here that I'm not super pleased upon re-listening about how I maybe represented the movement. I think it becomes clear to me that I'm not maybe as familiar with the movement's goals as maybe I should have been. So definitely don't take me as any sort of authority figure when it comes to talking about the movement, and just go read your own sources and make up your own mind about what the movement actually stands for.
Yeah, and if Ben is issuing a caveat, then I should issue probably caveat squared, because I knew even less about the movement than Ben. But at least when I was listening to it, I thought Ben did a fair job. But I guess people have to judge for themselves. But yeah, so I had read a little bit about it, maybe 2 or 3 days leading up to the conversation. And again, neither of us are pretending to be experts. We're just exploring things that we think are interesting, but we obviously want to give any idea its fair due. So
And as much as it pains me to admit it, I must say that especially in the latter half of the conversation, I think you do change my mind about some stuff, or at least clarify some concepts that I think had been sort of muddled in my head. So even if listeners aren't particularly interested in the very specific problem of prison abolition, we do move on later and talk about just some more general philosophical concepts. And that was very clarifying for me. And that's why I'll sound like a fucking moron at the end of the conversation. I think it's definitely worth listening to just for that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, so do you want to set up this conversation? Because this is much more your domain than mine, but I'm really excited for it because I've been doing some reading, and the topic is really fascinating. So perhaps you want to kick it off.
Yeah, so I suppose the general question for me is kind of the broader problem of when to favor incremental change over radical reform. And I'm starting to come across this more and more. One is I just try and decide like what to do and what to study and with my life and like what sort of career to go into. I'm trying to take sort of a lot of perspectives into account and decide what sort of worldviews I want to pay attention to ethically, basically. And there's, of course, a sizable fraction of people who are always like very discontented with some aspect of the status quo, reasonably, right? Like, status quo is never going to work well for, you know, everyone, let alone most people. And people seem to have different responses as to what to do about this. There's people who say, like, bring down the system, the whole thing's broken, we need to tear it down and restart. And whether they're talking about the system, like, the whole system as it exists, or just some part of the system, depends on the person and the issue. And then some people want to leverage policy and work towards some sort of change via using the institutions and changing things within the institutions, right? And so I've just sort of become, in the abstract, interested in this question of when to favor this sort of incremental change versus radical reform. And this question manifested itself more concretely for me in chatting with a friend who favors prison abolition. And so this is a movement that seeks to abolish the prison system in the U.S., and presumably also worldwide, but as I've come across it, I think they're mostly focused on the U.S., probably for good reason, too. The American prison system houses, I think, 1/4 of all the quote-unquote criminals in the world, and definitely has the highest per capita rate of incarceration. But anyway, so the driver behind this movement is the idea that we don't need to just reform the prison system as it exists. We need to abolish it entirely, right, as the name suggests. And in fact, reforms to the prison system are often harmful and are viewed very, very negatively because they, as people in the movement would put it, they sort of uphold the system which has put this prison industrial complex enabled this thing to exist. And so this is like a perfect sort of distillation for me of this question versus of incrementalism versus radical reform. So on one side, you might have people who say, yes, the prison system sucks as it is. We're housing way too many criminals, or our laws are too stringent, and it's just harming the very communities we're trying to protect. But the remedy for this situation is to work from within the system and try and pass bills, try and pass laws to make prisons, maybe reduce the number of prisons being built, and to try and reform the behavior of guards towards prisoners within prison, make conditions better and more manageable, reduce sentence length, all these kind of things. And then you'd have people saying any reform on this front just re-emphasizes the underlying narrative that prisons are necessary in the first place. And this, in and of itself, is unacceptable. And what we need to push for is a complete abolishment of the whole system. And so reform is actually viewed very negatively because it sort of diverts one's attention from the true underlying problem. And you are trying to fix some deep structural problem with quote-unquote like band-aid solutions, right? You're just kind of throwing band-aids at it, hoping things will go away, and diverting your attention from the true underlying structural issues. And so, yeah, so I just started to try and engage with this question for myself broadly at the level of like, when do we favor incremental reform versus radical change, and more specifically for this question of prison abolition. And I think it's a nice... it's a nice representative problem. The prison abolition problem, rather, it's a nice representation of the more general problem, because most people in the U.S. actually agree that the current prison system is kind of a mess. Like, it's one of the issues that sort of does have bipartisan support, surprisingly. So both Democrats and Republicans most of the time we'll readily admit that the prison system as it exists is like not optimal at all. And we do need to change it. But then there's just a question of like, how do you go about changing it? Right. So that's been kind of my introduction to the problem. And now I've just been struggling with like, yeah, how do I think about this? What does prison abolition actually look like? Would society be ready for something like that? How do you know if society is ready for something like that? What would that mean to just like abolish the prisons? Would something replace it? Or, so all the dealing with all the consequences of that. So that's my general setup.
Awesome. Yeah. So I think it might be nice to structure this this conversation as trying to spend maybe the first half really exploring the prison abolition movement specifically. And then after we explore this movement, then we can zoom out perhaps a bit more and talk about just incremental change versus grand revolutions and piecemeal engineering versus utopian engineering, as it's often been put. So this topic is really fascinating, and it wasn't one that I was very familiar with before about a week ago when you had suggested it. And so I spent the last week or so kind of reading various various sources on the prison abolition movement. Two names kept coming up, Ruth Wilson Gilmore and Angela Davis. And so I read two pieces, one for, by each of them. And I guess to kind of kickstart this, I'd love to just ask some basic questions about this movement to you to see kind of if I'm understanding it correctly. So one question you touched on is the, let's say, the distinction between prison reform and prison abolition. I had read, I think, let's see if I can pull it up, actually, a piece by Angela Davis, who was a lot less hostile towards prison reform than you had just indicated. And so let me actually pull this up so that I can quote it. So this is from the journal Social Justice. It was written in 2000, and it's titled The Challenge of Prison Abolition, A Conversation. And the conversation is between Angela Davis and Dylan Rodriguez. And close to the end of the conversation, the question of prison reform versus prison abolition comes up. And so Angela Davis is asked explicitly, what are the most crucial distinctions between the political commitments and agendas of prison reformists and those of the prison abolitionists? To which she answers, I'm going to summarize because it's a rather long answer. In other words, I do not think that there is a strict dividing line between reform and abolition. For example, it would be utterly absurd for a radical prison activist to refuse to support the demand for better health care inside Valley State, California's California's largest women's prison, under the pretext that such reform would make the prison a more viable institution. And she goes on to along these lines. So I guess my question to you is twofold. How unified is this movement? Because it sounds like your experience talking to your friend who basically says that the abolitionists want nothing to do with the reformists because it's just Band-Aid solutions. Sounds like your friend would perhaps disagree with Angela Davis, who I guess is one of the leading spokespersons for this movement. So how unified is the movement? And do you know if perhaps what I'm reading is just kind of out of date, and now the movement is quite hostile towards reform in general? Because, as you said, reform is something that I think everybody agrees with. It's almost a non-issue. It's just a question of how do we actually reform the prisons. But so I guess I'd love to hear more from you carving out the distinction between the abolitionists and the reformists in the context of U.S. prison reform.
Yeah, so these are all super good questions. One thing I should say is I'm definitely not like an expert on the prison abolition movement whatsoever, so I'm sort of at the same level as you. I'm just like gathering various bits of information, reading articles. Definitely not an expert by any means. Yep. And so, yeah, nothing I say should be taken to represent the movement whatsoever.
So we're both two outsiders kind of trying to study this and figure out what we think about it.
Yep. Yeah, this is certainly not an episode of Ask the Expert or something.
But did I recall you earlier, perhaps in a previous conversation, saying that you are a prison abolitionist, as in you think that this should take place? Or did I misremember you saying that?
Yeah, I think I'm relatively persuaded that prison all around is just not the way to solve things. I mean, so beforehand, I would have said I'm very anti-retributive justice, and I think we should be moving towards a system of sort of restorative justice. I've been like persuaded by sort of Tamler Summers on these kind of views. He's got a book called Relative Justice, in which he one of the chapters makes the case. And so that was like sort of my bias going into it. That was one bias going into it. And then there's also the fact that I am a consequentialist. So, you know, at the end of the day, I sort of want to do what's going to bring about the most good for the most people. And I'm just not, you know, I think, and most people would agree, the evidence just doesn't suggest that, like, locking people up for long periods of time for major or minor offenses does much good for anyone, for them or the communities. And so in general, I think, I'm very sympathetic to the idea that prison is just kind of like the wrong way to solve these problems, especially prison as it exists today, of like complete separation from society, where any issues just seem to be exacerbated. People come out of the prison system less equipped than they went into it to like handle any sorts of problems, and are just like thrown back into the world, and then not allowed to make like any sort of mistakes afterwards. And so this just sort of like vicious cycle of people being put into prison and then being, you know, thrown out into a world in which they're often like poor now. They don't have skills to manage themselves or help their families or anything. And this just, I think, lends itself to like a very, very vicious cycle. So I am very sympathetic to the idea. Just the general critique of prison is just, this is not a good way to solve social problems. And this is just like not contributing to the welfare of our society in any good way. So when I say I'm a prison abolitionist, it may not be for the precise reasons that drives a lot of people in the abolitionist movement, but in general, I am like, quite sympathetic with the general thrust of the critique. But yeah, back to the question of like reform versus abolition. So yeah, it definitely had been my interpretation of some of the pieces I'd read and what my friend had been telling me, that there is somewhat of a divide between those who would seek to support reform and those who would call themselves strident abolitionists. And so even the example you cite that seems maybe at first glance uncontroversial, which was to support better healthcare for those in prison, right? Maybe we'll have to come up with a better word for this, but like a strident abolitionist, say, would actually say, you know what, this does at first glance appeal to our intuitions that this is a good thing. Who could vie against healthcare for those in need? But what this actually does is allow us to pass some bill that's just going to allow us to look the other way, society in general, to look the other way about the entire prison issue and just get distracted by other policies, other things going on in the world. And then what's going to happen is then these prisons are going to be allowed to multiply in number, in the number of people they house, and it will actually allow the prison system to survive longer than it might have otherwise. I don't actually think this question of like, yeah, should you give better healthcare to people in prison is actually completely uncontroversial.
It's really interesting. So you talk about the strident prison abolitionist, and I guess when I started doing some research for this conversation, I was expecting to hear a lot of this really extreme black and white strident thinking. But I found Ruth Wilson Gilmore in particular to be quite nuanced, and she surprised me in a couple of places. So I guess before I comment on kind of the specifics of what you're saying, because I think I am quite critical of at least the position that any move to improve prison is actually harmful, and we should never work to improve the prison system. We should only seek to destroy it. I think that position I'm going to be quite critical of, but I want to at least say the parts of the movement which I was quite impressed by before I start criticizing. So in the piece by the New York Times, 2019, so quite a recent one, it was a profile of Ruth Wilson Gilmore. And it's titled, "Is Prison Necessary? Ruth Wilson Gilmore Might Change Your Mind." There's a couple excerpts from it that I thought were quite fascinating that I would love to highlight. One is that she says about midway through the piece that prisons are not a result of a desire by bad people to lock up poor people and people of color. The state did not wake up one morning and say, let's be mean to black people. All these other things had to happen that made it turn out like this. It didn't have to turn out like this. Excuse me, let me emphasize that slightly differently. All these other things had to happen that made it turn out like this. It didn't have to happen It didn't have to turn out like this. And so in that, she just displays a lot of nuance in her thinking. And I was expecting the prison abolition spokespeople to focus entirely on, let's say, the ideas that characterize the woke left now, that it's just the expression of systemic racism. It's just simply the capitalist system, the classism, all these isms, which I find to be quite dull now because it's just, you hear it over and over again. But she didn't demonstrate that. Later on, she also says that another misconception is that the prison system only affects black people, which she said is a false and harmful stereotype. And so it seems like she is quite interested in trying to not explicitly racialize this topic. And so I was quite impressed by a number of these points that showed that at least she was a much more nuanced thinker than I think I had expected. But then I started to question a lot of the material in that she was saying. And I guess the central question, which I would have expected to be paragraph two, is what are you going to replace prisons with? What's your alternative? And that the answer to that question seemed quite, let's say, underexplored. And so perhaps I can push this to you, which is what are the strongest alternatives to prison that the prison abolitionists are proposing? Because that seems like this topic and my support for this topic hinges on what alternatives have been proposed and what mechanisms have they used to stress test these various alternatives. Maybe I'll say one more thing, which is the prison abolition movement just simply criticizing prisons, or is it actually trying to propose alternatives and develop these alternatives?
So I think the first thing I think they're trying to do is just like defund the construction of new prisons so that like we don't expand the number of people who are like being thrown in prison every year, as the U.S. is like apt to do. And so I think that's the first goal. But I think this is like a super valid critique, an important critique that you're making, that the sort of what you'd replace it with is very undefined. And so in as much as I can get a handle on it, I think the general idea is that you will replace it with nothing. What needs to happen is that society needs to improve its levels of care for people at various levels. So we need to improve the homelessness rate, for example. We need to increase decrease inequality. We need to reduce all societal problems which like lead to crime in the first place. So I think they're trying to target like the root causes of crime and say that, look, ideally we should be able to build a society in which crime is less incentivized to take place, because instead of just trying to fix it after the fact with prisons, we take an a priori stance on crime and say, like, what's causing this in the first place? And then we should try and solve those issues. And so I think that's the general critique being raised by the abolitionist. And so there's a debate to be had about like how reasonable that is, right? There's a debate to be had which says, like, is it reasonable to expect that we can like solve all these problems, right? Like, this sounds kind of like just a utopian ideal to me, where we like go out and we try and construct a world in which there's like no incentive for anyone to commit crime, because there's no poverty, there's no class imbalance, any of these things, right? And that just sounds like a little bit insane. But I think,
or the utopia.
Yeah, exactly. But I still think there is value in people having this sort of critique, right? Regardless of whether this is exactly what's going to take place, I do think there's value in strident voices from the left in this case, trying to point at things that are like sort of structurally wrong with the current system.
I guess I see that as having some value, yes, but I also see it as just a huge opportunity cost, because I think that if there was a viable alternative to prisons, and so one I have heard is a focus on restorative justice, as you mentioned, and let me give a quote about what restorative justice looks like from one of the prison abolitionists, from the description from a prison abolitionist. So, through restorative justice, offenders are expected to fully account for their behavior in dialogue with the individual and the communities affected by their actions. They must then work with those parties to develop actions to try to repair the damage done as much as possible. The process is restorative because the goal is to restore the victim, their community, and the offender to how they were before the transgression occurred. And then they end with this by saying, people who commit violence are hurt by the violence they commit, and therefore need to be a part of the process that seeks to find justice for that violence. This comes from The Nation. The article is titled, What is Prison Abolition? Okay, so when I first read that, I thought, that sounds quite nice. People who commit violence are hurt by the violence they commit. But then if you replace the word violence with, say, rape, people who commit rape are hurt by the rape they commit. It doesn't sound as nice to the ear, and I think it starts to expose the difficulties with this kind of alternatives. And I just was, first I was initially impressed by Ruth Wilson Gilmore and the movement. But then I started to think that a lot of their proposed alternatives are quite surface level and essentially platitudinous. They're just platitudes. People who commit violence are hurt by the violence they commit. But then you think about applying that, say, to Harvey Weinstein. Or you think about applying that to Bill Cosby. You know, Bill Cosby committed violence, and he too was hurt by the violence he committed. I think that the prison system, specifically in the United States, is a huge problem. Like, a quote that really got me was that in 2008, the incarceration rate in the U.S. exceeded the Soviet Union during the Gulag system, meaning one in 100 people in the U.S. were imprisoned. And so that is clearly a huge fucking problem. The alternatives which are being proposed by people who are on the forefront of the prison abolition movement seem to be quite flimsy. And this is where I mean by opportunity cost, because I think it's easy to get up every day and say, down with the system, fuck the system, and feel like you've done a hard day's work, when really the kind of work we need are rolling up your sleeves and starting to figure out what could viably replace the system. And if the best that I get when I read the spokespeople's words are platitudes, like people who commit violence are hurt by the violence they commit, then I think the movement is only going to be sustained by hatred of the system, and it's not trying to propose any viable alternatives. I want to respond also to something you said earlier, which is that the evidence doesn't support that prisons are effective in reducing violence. I think that was something that you said. And so I went back and I was looking at what Steven Pinker had written about prisons in his Better Angels of Our Nature book, because he describes the decline of violence over the last 2,000 years and talks about what are the various drivers of the decline of violence. And prisons do serve a purpose. So he makes one point which I think is quite intuitive, which is that in a lot of cases, there's like a Pareto principle of violence at work, where a very few number of people commit a large percentage of the total violence. And so he quoted a study that was, I think, a little old, 2000. It's like a classic study done saying that 6% of people in, I believe, Pennsylvania. Let's see if I can pull this up. No, I won't try to find it. But about 6% of the people committed a majority of the violence. And therefore, if you remove said people from society, the violence is going to decrease. The problems, at least in the U.S., come from when you start locking up people for nonviolent drug offenses and stuff. But it also seems to me that people in the prison abolition movement aren't really grappling with the purpose that prisons are solving. Excuse me, that was a bad sentence. Aren't grappling with some of the benefits of prison, such as removing the most violent from society. And so these two things, the kind of the slightly surface level and flimsy alternatives that I've read, plus kind of a refusal to acknowledge that prisons can be useful in some scenarios, starts to make me worried about this movement, because unlike the reformists who say prison is pretty fucked up in the US and we need to fix it, but by definition, fixing it implies that there is some utility of prison. Unlike the reformists, the abolitionists seem to refuse to acknowledge these kind of difficult truths. And so I guess I want to put that to you to see if that description is fair, or if it if I've gone off in some, if I've said something that's incorrect, or if this is kind of mirrors your experience talking to your abolitionist friends.
Yeah, it mirrors the experience a bit. I mean, I think the critique that they're not acknowledging the useful purpose that prison is solving is possibly slightly unfair. So I don't think, for example, anyone in the abolitionist movement would say that like murder is okay, and we just shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't do anything about murder. Like, we shouldn't try to reduce murder rates, try and impose any restrictions on those who commit murder or anything like that. I think they just want to ask the sort of the deeper structural question of, like, what's causing someone to commit murder in the first place? And I think what unites people in the prison abolition movement is they think that the causes which cause someone to commit murder in the first place are societal and, like, can be solved, and are a result of very real, for example, structural inequalities or something that exists within the current system. And so I think the gap between, like, you and an abolitionist is, I think you're taking society as more fixed, or viewing it as possibly like it's harder to change, and therefore within the current system, the best thing we can do is to, have prisons. Obviously, we don't want them to be big and incarcerating 1 out of 100 people, but we do want them to incarcerate those who are going to pose very severe threats to society. Whereas I think someone in the abolition movement has more optimism about how society could change and what sort of problems are possible to solve.
But the phrase structural reform, I know you're not using it like yourself, you're kind of speaking on behalf of a movement, but like, I don't even know what the fuck the phrase structural reform means. Here's how I would interpret structural reform. Say trying to completely get rid of the war on drugs, which is responsible for a huge increase in nonviolent drug offenders being incarcerated. The changing of laws, changing of institutions such that we achieve the desired outcome, which is reducing violence and reducing the number of people who are incarcerated. That is how I would interpret the phrase structural reform. But it's being used in the sense of, no, we don't want to do any of that. We want structural reform. We want to get the real underlying cause. We don't want to, say, reform the prison movement, the prisons in the United States, which I would just say is a structure. We don't want to reform that structure. We want to abolish it, and we want true structural reform. So what do they mean? The word structure is, I think, just a placeholder word to prevent deeper thought.
I mean, I think, and so this is what like puts a wedge between me, I think, and like the actual core of the movement, is I think generally it comes down to problems tangential to like capitalism, or problems that arise from living in a society that like accumulates wealth in quote unquote like unjust ways, right? So before we like
Soviet Union didn't have prisons,
right? Yeah, exactly. But what I'm trying to get at is like the differing viewpoint between someone, like what would cause someone to be an abolitionist, and I think it's the general take that like we should be and could be trying to solve what in their view they would view as like these structural problems, meaning inequality when it comes to like wealth inequality and just general problems that arise from the capitalist system that we live in. And so regardless of whether you agree with that, I think, you know, the general psychology that differentiates what I'm calling like a reformer versus an abolitionist is one in which it's the extent to which you believe that sort of underlying system like can be changed and reduce the reduce whatever causes are making crime necessary in the first place, right? So I think a reformer takes those kind of as given, as like, look, we're never going to hit a point, we're never going to hit a steady state where just like everyone's happy enough and no one's going to commit crime, no one's incentivized to commit crime. Whereas I think the abolitionist is slightly more optimistic and says like, no, we can solve these issues, whatever you think the issues are. And also we have a duty to, we should be trying to solve these issues. And so now there's the question of like, what the hell are those issues in the first place? And is it reasonable to try and solve them? And that's when I really differ with the abolitionist, because I think like, you know, regardless of whatever global economic system you're living under, no, you know, it's never going to be perfectly just, quote unquote, you know, no one's ever going to be perfectly equal, or if they are, they're going to be completely equal at the bottom, right? That's definitely the biggest problem I have, is like there's sort of this idea that like we can solve all these problems just doesn't seem practical.
Worse than not seeming practical, I think that the actions of the abolitionists as you've described them, and I'm just going to put a caveat that there's perhaps a difference between the beliefs of the leaders, the Gilmores and the Davises, and the beliefs of people who you meet on the street who identify as an abolitionist. So let me just criticize the kind of the picture you've just painted, and not apply this so much to Ruth Wilson Gilmore. But the actions of the person you just described will probably make the lives of prisoners in the United States much worse than somebody who just does absolutely nothing. What do I mean by this? I mean that in one of the articles, I think it's like The Nation, perhaps, they talked about the big success in California was they prevented a couple new prisons from being built. So if this is kind of the what counts as a success in the prison abolition movement, then I see them directly contributing to prison overcrowding, because they're not reducing the amount of violence. They're not reducing the amount of incarceration. They're just making fewer places to put those who are incarcerated. Therefore, making the conditions of people who are incarcerated much worse. And I see this as a big problem, because if your primary interest isn't really to help prisoners, it's not really to address the laws which are causing the prisons to be filled in the first place, but it's just to try to burn the fucking system down. If that's what your underlying motive is you just hate capitalism so much that you just want to reduce the number of prisons, then you don't really care about the people who are locked up, or at least your actions belie your stated interests, because your actions are creating additional suffering for those who are caught in the system, or at least so that seems to me. I contrast that against perhaps someone who's more of a reformist, which at least as described, I'm now identifying myself as, who says the war on drugs is a horrible policy, and we need to petition and raise awareness, do everything we can to abolish this policy, such that we don't just flood the prisons with nonviolent drug offenders. Such a person, I think, is acting in a way that, even if they're not perfectly successful, all of the intermediate successes they have will still aggregate towards making the lives of people in the system better. So even if they don't 100% achieve their goal, a 50% achievement of the goal is still helping. Contrasted against people who just want to burn it down. And if they achieve 50% of their goal, then they just make the lives of prisoners much worse by having fewer places into which you're stuffing more and more people. And so I guess this starts to perhaps lead us to the second half of the conversation, which is the more philosophical side of things, which it is for this reason that I am in favor of gradual incremental change, because the whole point of gradual change is that it can always, one's actions can always be reevaluated, and you can say, prevent a prison from being built, reflect that, well, there's still a lot of people being incarcerated, and then pivot, and then change, and then do something else. And you're not ideologically attached to one and only one outcome, but you're more open to new evidence and new ideas as they come to you. And so I guess I should kind of see what you think about all that, but it might...
It's interesting. So let me ask the question of, suppose stopping the construction of new prisons this year leads to overcrowding for the next 5 years. But then the overcrowding is to such a drastic extent that the state decides, holy shit, or there's protests or something, but for some reason the state's like, yo, we gotta stop incarcerating so many people because this is insane, you know? There's two people to a bed, basically. And so, yes, you've caused more suffering for people, right now, but in general, this could lead to longer-run consequences, or longer-run better consequences. Whereas, if you purely take an incremental approach, you might obstruct the construction of a new building, take stock of where you're at, and that would involve just seeing that you've created misery for some amount of prisoners right now, and then you'd say, oh, that's obviously the wrong track, because this is going nowhere good. And so that does close off the door to what, in this thought experiment, would actually be the better way to go. Let's just assume that, you know, closing prisons would lead to a massive reduction in the number of people incarcerated for petty crimes or something, right? And so all that, what I'm trying to get at is, there is this philosophical problem to incrementalism where you do shut off the door to, right? If you're only getting feedback from the system as it exists right now, you do seem to be closing off possible options that would have only been reachable had you continued on down some path and disregarded present level consequences.
I don't think so at all. Sorry, finish your point, but I don't think that's the case. But
that's the general point. So yeah, take it away.
I guess maybe we should start by saying a little bit about what incrementalism is now that we're moving to the more philosophical part of the subject. So I think a misconception about let's keep using the phrase incrementalism, or piecemeal social engineering is another, at least searchable phrase.
Yeah.
but so I think a big misconception of this movement is that, excuse me, not even movement, this approach is probably the easiest way to describe it, is that it's potentially limited in its aims. And so that's not the case at all. You can, let's use the prison abolition example. So let's say that I am absolutely convinced that we need to abolish prisons. I think that the only way to viably do that would be via a incrementalist approach. So to be, quote, an incrementalist is not to say that you are closing the door to large changes. You could work to flatten economic inequality and thereby work towards bringing about some sort of socialist utopia via incrementalism. So it's not to say that to be an incrementalist is to not want to achieve big change. It's only to say that the way that you achieve such change is by comparing the results obtained to the results expected. So it's just the scientific method applied to societal change. And so to your example of, let's say closing prisons is the only way to achieve this, but it's going to be about a 5-year time horizon, then here's how you would do it incrementally. You would say, okay, I expect that closing a prison is going to put pressure on politicians, but it's going to take about 5 years. And I'm also going to be a little bit cautious in my my actions, because I know that dealing with these complicated, chaotic, stochastic systems like society, the chances of there being unforeseen consequences to my actions is quite high. So I'm going to try this in, say, one state in the U.S. I'm going to see after 5 years if it actually does lead to the change that I think it's going to lead to. And then I'm going to compare my expectation for what's going to happen against what actually happens, and then update my behavior at that point. So there's nothing about the incrementalist approach which prevents the strategy which you laid out. It's more just a way... It's an openness and a receptivity to the idea that perhaps my favorite approach might be wrong, and therefore I need to be a little bit cautious when I'm implementing my favorite approach, because the lives of human beings are on the line, and I need to, at every stage, be slow, just to make sure that I don't inadvertently hurt more people than I help. And so there's nothing closing the door to this of the incrementalist to say the prevention of new prisons going up. It's more just an attitude that says I could be wrong and I need to check. That's it.
Yeah, good. Okay.
So
you're putting your finger directly on the benefit of incrementalism, and that is that you get to get feedback as you're proceeding through, as you're trying to
even if
goals,
that
right?
feedback is, say, at like a 5-year horizon. So even if it's a slow thing, it's still
right.
Still
so you get to like stop, you get to evaluate consequences at some time horizon, and then you get to say, okay, given that feedback, now how should we proceed? And in this way, it's like trial and error processing, right? And so presumably you're going to hurt less people along the way. My slightly more theoretical point is that you have to be able to predict the consequences. So let's say, going back to the prison example, let's say you didn't predict that this was going to lead to overcrowding, or that the time horizon would just be 5 years, right? And so the thought experiment is that closing prisons is going to lead to short-term harm, but long-term gain. But if you, as a reformer, or, you know, if you don't see that, then you're going to be put off but at the first bit of feedback. So you're going to close a prison, you're going to see that it leads to overcrowding, and you're going to say, oh, okay, that's like harming more lives than I wanted, right? I didn't think this was going to have any negative externalities, and so now I'm going to stop. I'm going to go down some approach. And so the general point here is that you would have need to foreseen that this was going to take approximately a 5-year time horizon for any of the positive benefits to kick into effect, right? And if you don't have that foresight, then the evaluation of your incremental approach is it's only as good as what you can imagine the consequences to be, basically, right? So, like,
but you never have, like, you're positing some, like, perfect knowledge that we could have. You're saying in this thought experiment, it is the case that this one action will eventually lead to good consequences, but there's no way we could actually know it. Yeah. But it's only through this absolutism that we could find that.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
this is completely divorced from how the world actually works at all.
How do you know that though? Right.
It's divorced because there is a set of say 50 actions in front of you that at any point you could take, and you never know which action is going to be leading to this desired conclusion. And so it's not as if by being incrementalist, we're like ignoring the one that actually is going to work. It's that we don't know at all.
Yeah.
And any action is only ever chosen because we think it's superior to the alternative actions. And so all you can do is choose between a set of things that you don't know, for which you don't have extra omniscient knowledge about the outcome. And so you have to be incrementalist and cautious because you don't have any other choice.
Right.
That's what I mean. It's divorced from reality.
Yeah. Okay. Fair. I mean, what I'm trying to get at is that it's not a requirement of life that incrementalism gets you the best results. It seems possible to me that you achieve some like quantum tunneling effect with a radical approach where I'm not saying you can predict the consequences. That's not what I'm saying at all. Like, of course you can't predict the consequences. Life is like messy and complex. I'm saying radical approaches, what they do is short circuit the need for any immediate feedback because you don't care about that. And you just like charge along some path. And most of the time, yeah, this path gets you somewhere that you don't want to be. But, theoretically, this could get you somewhere that you just wouldn't have gotten with incrementalism because you're precisely not paying attention to the feedback, right? And so I think this is
totally don't yeah. agree. But sorry, finish.
So this tunnel, you know, this tunnels through the hills and valleys of your feedback landscape, right? And just like you tunnel through this hill, and you're like, I don't give a shit where I'm going, and this just can take you to completely unexplored vistas. Now, there's the question of like, is this desirable? And I totally agree with you that it's not because one, you don't know where you're going to end up, right? And two, you're probably, and this is, you know, just historically based as well, you're probably just going to harm a lot of people and get nowhere good. And then, you know, we're going to have to call in the cavalry to like stop you. But my point is that it's not a given that a radical approach to something won't just like get you to somewhere that you couldn't have foreseen, right? And some better place than you'd get with incremental change.
It is a given. No, it is a given. It is a given. So what you're saying is there's no like fundamental law of the universe that says radical change is better or worse than incrementalism.
Right. Yeah.
First, is that a fair characterization
when you say
it's not a given?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that there actually is a fundamental principle of the universe. And that is about, so David Deutsch calls it his principle of optimism, which is essentially all problems can be solved given the right knowledge. So
Right. The
fundamental law of the universe is that we need knowledge in order to figure out how to solve these problems. We need knowledge about how to reduce the violence such that prisons are unnecessary. The only thing that is preventing us from doing this is lack of knowledge. And so the fundamental law of the universe, which I put to you, is that the only way we can solve these problems and any problem is through collecting the requisite knowledge. Okay, so how do we do that? We know that there's only one way to generate knowledge, and that's through the method of trial and error, conjectural epistemology. The radical reformer blocks off the ability to gain knowledge about their problem. They in order to gain knowledge about, say, how to reduce acts of violence, we need to propose various alternatives, tentatively test them, and compare the results obtained to the results expected. This is the only way we can solve our problem. if you subscribe to, let's say, the radical utopian approach, why does this not get us knowledge? So here's at least one reason, but I can give some additional ones. So if you do a huge societal change, let's say you and I tomorrow, we go and we just open up all of the prison doors, and now prisoners run through the streets. If we do a large change and it doesn't work, we don't know what to attribute the failure to because so much has happened, right? It could be that the rate of change is the thing that caused it to fail, or it could be that it was this particular prison, which was majority homicidal maniacs, but other prisons would that approach would work. And so the only way we can gain knowledge about our problem, when it is of matters as important as reducing the number of people incarcerated, is to test it and propose changes in such a way that we can attribute the outcomes to the particular change. And so I put to you as the it is actually a fundamental law of the universe, that and the law is that we need knowledge about our problem. And the abolitionist, the utopian engineer, the one who just says down with the system, blocks off the ability to gain knowledge about their problem because they aren't comparing the outcomes with their expectations and learning from those mistakes. And so that's my return volley.
That's nice. So so I agree that incrementalism does, if done in the right way, does generate knowledge. Now there's practical problems of even if you're evaluating on a relatively short time scale, trying to distill correlation and causation, all these things are pretty hard, right? This is the role of political science and economics and things at a broad level. But in general, I take the point that trying something, stopping to evaluate how it went, is the general way we produce knowledge, and we should probably link people to Popper's piece on knowledge here. But there's no guarantee that this will generate all knowledge given enough time. There could be vistas that are closed off to you, right? So this could, because it's only so good as your imagination that the knowledge you can will generate. So you have to imagine some solution to your problem, right? You enact the solution in some way, and you gather feedback, and then you evaluate it, right? So you have a problem, you propose a thesis, you implement something, and then you gather feedback about whether that worked, and then that generates knowledge in some abstract sense. And so in this model, you have to propose a hypothesis, right, for your problem. You have some problem, propose a hypothesis to solve it. And so the knowledge you generate will only be as good as the hypotheses that you generate in the first place, right? And I think the radical's claim here is that you can just jump to a whole new level.
No, it sounds like you're claiming.
And so you know, once you hit, okay, so let's say, bring this down to a more.
It sounds like you're claiming that the radical can generate hypotheses that the incrementalist can't.
No.
What you're saying.
So
is that true?
I think they discard the system. They discard the Popper's whole system of knowledge generation for a little bit, and they find themselves in some society which works better or worse, right? And so so let's go back to your example. Just we open up all the prison doors, right? Okay, so I think this could go one of two ways. Either it's worse than the status quo, or it's better than the status quo. Okay, and either way, once you've got there, right? So you opened up, you hit some new peak or valley, and now you don't know what the causes were, right? You can't say what to attribute the change to. You're there's a lot of confounding factors there. We just did this, and then 10 years later, we're in some spot, and then we don't know really how we got here, but. But now you're in a new spot that you wouldn't have hit it had you adopted incrementalism. And so I think the radical's claim here is that like you're hitting a spot that you never would have hit otherwise. So it does open up new possibilities in this sense, right? And so you might not know. So now there's a general critique. Like now, once you.
But this is a triviality bet. You could say, I'm going to propose a new philosophical idea, and it's not incrementalism. It's not radical change, but it's blueism. And my policy is going to be to just paint everything blue. By doing so, now you're in a whole radically new place. You have now opened up a whole new vista of ideas, which it's a whole new vista of possibilities that you would never have thought of if you weren't a bluist.
Right.
But that it's a banality because every action you take, by definition, puts you in a new place that you wouldn't have been had you not taken that action, and you are only ever limited by your ingenuity and your hypotheses, as you said, and so at every point we're always just limited by the ideas we're able to generate, and whenever we take an action, by definition, we're going to be in a place that we would never have been had we not taken that action, and that isn't something that is unique to the radical reformer that the incrementalist doesn't have, in the same way that. To be a bluist is not to put you in a new place that the incrementalist doesn't have. It's just by definition that's the case. And so, I guess I don't see it as a strength of utopianism that you are in entirely new vistas. I just see it as a limitation that when you get to this new vista, you're not going to be able to learn from it. At all, because you don't have the mechanisms that allow you to learn. So you could be in a new vista, but unless upon being there, you then start to gather knowledge in the only way that we know how, then it doesn't matter if you're if the vista is on the banks of utopia, because you won't be able to harvest anything. You won't be able to learn from any of the mistakes, and the vista is completely closed off to you.
Yeah.
So,
okay. Blueism aside, I think this is a pretty persuasive argument. I'm definitely, in general in favor of incrementalism and what you're talking about. And, you know, Popper's theories of falsification.
And the other thing that Popper says about this. Oh, sorry. No, you go.
No, because I was going to take us off on a slightly different tangent, so feel free to.
Yeah, let me say one more comment about Popper. Actually, not even about Popper, but he's just where a lot of these ideas come from, but the ideas obviously can stand on their own, which is that let's say you're a utopian and you propose some radical change for society. Let's just keep using the example of opening the floodgates. You're going to propose this change. You're going to make. You're going to be in a new vista, and then what's going to happen? There's going to be all sorts of things going wrong and things going right, and all you're going to be able to do when you're in this new vista is slight tweaks and changes and modifications. The floodgates open, and all of a sudden, all the prisoners are crowding downtown Vancouver. And so, okay, well, now I have to deal with that problem. So you have to go and figure out a way to corral them so they're elsewhere. Like, I could keep going with this silly thought experiment. But the point is that it's not actually even possible to not take an incrementalist approach. Because with every action, there's going to be small modifications and changes and tweaks that you're going to need to deal with the day that the action has been taken. The only difference is that with the incrementalist, they're aware of the process in advance and they know what's going to come. And so they have a receptivity to these kind of changes and they're prepared for it. Where the utopianist is convinced of the absolute truth of and the rightness of their action, they take a big step and then a bunch of shit goes wrong, and then they have to start incrementally trying to fix the things that have gone wrong, and they're completely oblivious to the mechanism. And so it's not even possible to not do the incrementalist approach, because and just read a little bit about the history of like what happened after the Red Army took over Moscow, and they all of a sudden the harvests were not as fruitful as planned, and it turns out that Marx's dictum that the workers should run the factories didn't contain enough information to how that's actually going to be done, and so then they just had to start improvising. And then Lenin eventually said, well, you know what, we should maybe let the farmers have a bit of their private property with his new economic policy or what have you. And so both in theory and in practice, all that ever happens is you get feedback and changes to what's been done. The only difference is that one side, the incrementalist, is humble enough to think that they could be wrong, and therefore cautious enough to not make bold steps without verification that what they're doing isn't causing more harm than good. So I just wanted to say that extra thing before we pivot.
Nice. Yeah. I like it. So I guess, do you think there's no situation under which you'd prefer some sort of radical change versus some sort of incrementalism? So take like abolishing slavery, for example, like what, you know, what's the...
Precisely. Yeah. So, there are, and I was thinking about this, did I support, say, the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak during the Arab Spring?
Yeah, right, exactly.
Or the Haitian Revolution overthrowing the colonialists in Haiti. Or the American Revolution kind of getting under out from under the British taxation policy and monarchs and stuff. And the answer is yes, of course I support these things, because... at least for all of these instances, they all have one thing in common, and that is revolting against tyranny, right? And so there is something unique, in fact, about a grand revolution against a tyranny, because a tyranny is the thing which is preventing the incrementalism which I'm advocating, right? So democracy is the way that we... incrementally improve our society, and a tyranny is that which prevents this process from getting started. And so, it's been variously described as the paradox of tolerance or the paradox of democracy.
Yeah.
A tolerant society can't be tolerant of the intolerant, otherwise it will destroy itself. And so, the overthrow of tyranny is something which I'm of course in favor of, and I think that that is just removing the block that is preventing this incremental process from taking place.
Right.
But you could then challenge me and say, well, are there any revolutions that don't overthrow tyrannies which you support? And I think the answer is probably no, or at least I can't think of any. The abolition of slavery is, of course, by definition, a tyranny. And so I'm obviously receptive to this, but in all of the instances which I can think in which I support kind of revolutionary change, they always are about overthrowing tyranny.
Right, okay. So it sounds like you have one overriding principle of Vaden's free society, and that is you want to live in a society that has a correction mechanism itself. And if you are in a society that doesn't have this mechanism, you can undergo radical action to try and generate such a society in by any means. And then once you enter into such a society, then you should be taking incremental approaches to...
David Deutsch said in, I think in his the interview on the Dilemma podcast, that on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, he... thinks that there's no such thing as a foundational moral principle. But then on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, he thinks that the foundational moral principle is do not destroy the error-correcting mechanism. And so I am obviously very influenced by him. And it, like, if there was going to be a foundational principle, I probably would nominate that one, that do not destroy the means of correcting errors. But... I think that there isn't such a foundational principle, and practically what I mean by that is even that principle should be able to be criticized. And so if you want to criticize the hell out of that principle, bring it on by all means. So that's, I guess, slightly off subject, but yes, that's correct. Those are the kinds of revolutions which I support, which are those which allow error correction to start taking place. So.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I guess my one critique would just be that it's hard. It may be after the fact, it's easy to see that, for example, a tyranny has been replaced by democracy, and therefore you are now in a society where that has such a correction mechanism. But I think it's much less black and white than that a lot of the times, right? You might have like a tyranny that succeeded by another tyranny, or a democracy that's only a puppet democracy that really doesn't work very well. Or there's a question of like whether even what we think of as very robust democracies actually work that well as having error correction mechanisms.
Well,
how robust is the error correction mechanism in the United States, for example, or in Canada? And you know, it's definitely more so under a monarchy or something, but probably less so than in the pauper's perfectly open society.
Yeah, well, I guess the question there is like compared to what? Something better, it could always, of course, be better, and we need like that's why we need to continue to improve our society, and that's why I was surprisingly persuaded by a lot of the arguments from the prison abolition movement, because I think that at least from the lead spokespeople, Gilmore and Davis, they aren't nearly as hardlined as the kind of the other side of the movement which you've described. And so to the extent that they're not hardline, and to the extent that they're pointing out some problem in our society and working towards reforming it, I'm completely in favor of that, because you just look at the statistics about how brutal the prison system is, and it's like you said, it's bipartisan that we want to reform it. It's just the question of how do we do so without making things worse is a really important one. And so the United States and Canada and the rest of the world, even though they're democracies, they still have a long way to go to get better. And that's part of the reason I like emphasizing the error correction aspect of it, because it doesn't presuppose perfection. It doesn't say this is the best. In fact, it presupposes that it's far from perfect and that all we can ever do is work to make it better. So let's keep criticizing our own society in order to improve it. But maybe like that's something else we should highlight, the distinction between those who use words like systemic and structural compared to those who use words like error correction and incrementalism. One camp thinks that our society is fundamentally rotten and needs to be replaced, and the other camp thinks our society is good but could be so much better. Or in Hans Rosling's terms, bad but better. Things are bad, but they're much better than they were in the past, and they can continue to get better. And so maybe, I know we're passing the hour mark, but maybe as a way to start closing down, it's just, what do you think of like the deep philosophical difference in perspective between the two sides, one which works to improve from within and the other which works to destroy from without, I guess. Obviously, I'm biasing it in the way I ask the question, but yeah, just what are your kind of thoughts along this space?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, right? So your overriding principle is that one should reject forms of tyranny and then try and enter a society that has some sort of mechanism for progress. And what I think distinguishes this sort of view from someone who, rails against the current system as fundamentally rotten is just precisely the definition of tyranny, right? So what I imagine someone who is against the quote-unquote like global capitalist order would say is like, this is a form of tyranny, right? And so we do need radical reform to rid ourselves of this sort of like oppressive society. And so they're just differing on what you qualify as tyranny. And I think this is like a very difficult problem, actually, because you can now agree on the fundamental philosophical principle of trying to make decisions in society. Like, one, principle one, rid yourself of tyranny. Principle two, implement error correction. But you might just differ on your definition of tyranny, right? And so this actually seems to me to be a super hard problem to resolve. And tyranny does seem to be somewhat of a relative concept, right?
Yeah, for sure. I have to reply to that. So I think that's an excellent point, and I think that we can make progress in this space by just putting a moratorium on the word tyranny for a bit, because as soon as people say, well, I consider the United States a tyranny, and you consider the Soviet Union a tyranny, and so we're at a gridlock, then I say, okay, the word tyranny has no longer is no longer serving to be helpful here, and let's use other words. So, for example, I think that even the most ardent, let's say, anti-capitalist would acknowledge that there's a voting mechanism in the United States which doesn't exist in North Korea. Say that we could talk about the imperfections and how many people are being denied the vote, but there is still a voting mechanism, right? There is still the ability to remove a leader without violence. And so Popper, and me, because I'm influenced by him, tends only to refer, let me rephrase that. By tyranny, he only means, and I only mean, any society which is able to remove a leader without violence. That's it. And so that's a much more objective criteria for what we count as, quote, tyrannies and not tyrannies. So if you're going to just define the word tyranny to mean a society which doesn't allow leaders to be removed without violence, then I think we can start to make some progress. Because I think that that actually does correspond to what the kind of conventional definition of tyranny is. But it's a lot more demarcating. And so I just put that on the table, not to say that this is the end of the conversation, but it's to say that despite the difficulties which you enumerated, that you could just say that the United States is a tyranny, there are ways to start to make progress, even despite two people having very different views. And I suggested perhaps one of them, but yeah. So.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I don't think anyone would disagree there's like fundamental differences between America and North Korea on many fronts, right? It's just the level to which you think people are oppressed by some given system, right? And I think there are people who very ardently believe that, like, the system in the U.S. is very oppressive to the majority of the people living here, or like just the West in general. The global capitalist order is oppressive, and it's a hard, I find it's a hard logic to argue against. Like, I find myself not being incredibly persuaded by it. You know, I think we have made substantial progress in most areas of life, and we are much better off now than we ever have been. But it's hard. It's hard rhetoric, I guess, to wrap your head around or to discuss with, because to some extent, if you argue that people are being oppressed, it does end the conversation to a certain extent, right? Like, because then you're arguing for, if you're arguing against this position, you're arguing for an oppressive regime, and that's no good.
I think it's a question of the language being quite unhelpful and actually preventing people who could be friends and work towards a common cause from being friends and working towards a common cause. So, let's say, hypothetically, that you think that the United States is just an oppressive regime. And I say, well, I don't think that it's an oppressive regime. Then we're stuck. But if instead you say, Vaden, I think that the U.S. prison system is disproportionately violent and it could be reformed, and that is what I define to be or that is why I think it's an oppressive regime, then I would come and say, I agree, let's work together to fix the prison system. I don't think it's an oppressive regime. I think it's, but who cares if we use this term or not, because we both have found common cause about, excuse me, we have both agreed that there is a problem which we can work to address. I can recognize that homelessness in Vancouver is a huge problem, that we need to do everything we can to fix it and to help, without saying that Vancouver is an oppressive regime which is subjugating the homeless population. And so I think in many cases, the language can be unhelpful, and we can find common cause with people to work towards reducing needless suffering, and we just temporarily decide to not argue about whether Canada is an oppressive regime, and we just say, we'll put a moratorium on that particular subject, and let's work together to fix something we both agree needs to be fixed. And so I think that progress can be made across the divide just by agreeing to not argue about certain things and instead work together to fix other things, I guess. So, but it's perhaps a nice place to pick up for our next conversation, which is this idea of is the West and the U.S. in particular just an oppressive, oppression-making monstrosity, or is it fundamentally different? Because I know exactly what you're talking about, which is some people just view it as intrinsically rotten, and there's nothing that can be done to fix or reform it. It just needs to essentially be destroyed. And if you think that way, then you're not going to make common cause with potential allies. You're only going to agree with those who want to see the whole thing just destroyed. And that is a problem which can't be easily solved by changing the language like I've been suggesting.
So. Jesus. All right. Well, I guess we're not staying out of the political weeds. Hey, we're just diving right into it. All right. I'm ready.
No, we definitely do that subject. No. Just a suggestion.
Yeah. But no, that was good, man. That was, appreciate. Yeah. That was a nice reconciliation, I think, of some of my disparate thoughts in different areas, sort of my pauper-like brain combating against some of my Californian brain, you know. That was helpful. That was nice.
That was a really, really good conversation. I